Nixon's Secretary of Defense. These reports were made verbally. No one wanted to leave a paper trail. Layard briefed Nixon himself, telling the president that there had been a collision, and it looked like the Soviet sub had sunk. Nixon's reaction, Layard recalls, was inscrutable. It was clear that the United States would not tell the Soviet Union about the unmarked underwater grave officials believed existed, perhaps only 50 miles off the coast of the Kamchatka Peninsula. Given the secrecy that surrounded all submarine operations, it went without saying that the White House was not going to announce that two nuclear-powered submarines, both carrying nuclear weapons, had met in one violent, possibly fatal moment. Besides, the Soviets were suffering so many at-sea accidents at the time, Nixon and his advisers decided the Soviets would likely blame another lost submarine on their own jinxed technology. A court of inquiry was convened, although just about everyone involved was already certain that the Soviet boat was lost. Indeed, Small, Moore, and Laird all say they remember specifically being told that the Echo had sunk. Other former senior Navy officers, including one who heard the sonar tapes, say that conclusion was based largely on the terrifying sounds captured on the recordings. But officials say that without more definitive evidence, a formal declaration that a Soviet sub had sunk would not have been made part of the Navy's official records. Shortly after the accident, James Bradley rushed out to Pearl Harbor to try to determine a cause. As best as anyone could guess, the Echo's captain had just made an unlucky and sudden maneuver. That in itself raised another issue. Bradley realized that U.S. captains were going to have to alter their techniques. As things stood now, the danger was too great that two subs would meet head-on at flank speed. If that happened, both subs would be lost. So Bradley wrote some new rules for trailing. One institutionalizing a favorite Whitey Mac technique, subs would now trail slightly to port or starboard of the enemy. That would leave the Americans more maneuvering room, while still allowing them to hide in the wash of noise coming from the hunted sub. There was another rule, however, that ran directly counter to Mac's style. Subs would now try to trail from safer distances. Bradley didn't blame Balderston for the incident, and Balderston, who had already been scheduled to leave Tautog, became commander of a division of four submarines that included her. Still, he had been right about making admiral. It would never happen. He retired 7 years later and became a Baptist minister, his heart weakened by his childhood rheumatic fever. He died in 1984. He never told his wife or children about the collision. Balderston's silence was typical. Bound to secrecy, submariners could not seek the kind of emotional solace that most men get from their wives and children when something goes wrong on the job. "It was not for him to tell," Irene L. Balderston says. "And I would never have dreamed of questioning him or of prying anything out of him." Just about the only ongoing discourse about the incident took place among members of Tautog's crew, who passed the story on to new members as they joined the boat. They whispered to one another about what had bent their crooked sail, and crew after crew of sonar men passed along a hidden bootleg recording, the sonar tapes made during the collision. Off the boat, the tapes were played in sonar school as an anonymous example of a Soviet sub sinking. Then, 2 decades later, the fate of the Echo II came surprisingly into question. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, Boris Bugdasarian, a former Soviet submarine commander, stepped forward to say that he was the captain of the Echo II that collided with Tautog, and that he was very much alive. With so few people in either the Soviet Union or the United States aware that their governments had long hidden a terrible accident, his account got little attention. But Bogdasarian tells a story that has been supported by high officials of the Russian Navy, and his tale meshes with many of the details provided by Tautog crew members, although there are a few small discrepancies. Sitting in his Moscow apartment, cigarette in hand, Bogdasarian's slight build and graying hair make him look more like an aging professor than a Soviet sea captain. But he had been a commander for more than a decade before he took the Echo 2 submarine, the Soviets called the Black Lila, out on a 3-day training run in June 1970. Bogdasarian had survived early experiments on Soviet diesel subs, staying underwater on one of the boats the Americans called Whiskey for 30 days, despite a design flaw that allowed exhaust gas to be sucked back into the sub through its snorkel. By the end of the month, the crew was so poisoned that their legs and hands were swollen to nearly twice their normal size. The Soviet Union chalked up the voyage as proof of the superiority of Soviet manhood. No wonder Bogdasarian had such a well-developed sense of political cynicism, and was so willing to speak out. He especially despised the Zampolits, the Kremlin's political officers, who were assigned to every submarine. Ostensibly, they were there to ensure that crews remained communistically correct, but Bogdasarian thought them drunks, pests, and inept nags, and let them know it. He roared at one, "You have been as useful as a suitcase on my submarine for 2 months." After the man accused Bogdasarian of playing outlaws music, when he put on a tape of a new popular singer to inspire his men. Nor was Bogdasarian afraid of the Americans. As he put it, he had once attacked the American battleship USS New Jersey, stalking her as she headed full speed for Vietnam's Gulf of Tonkin. Had he been given the order, he could have sunk her. He also had gone inside U.S. waters to try to trail an American ballistic missile submarine as it left Guam, later falsifying his patrol reports, as some U.S. commanders did. He never did manage to keep tail of a U.S. sub longer than 18 hours, a mere wink in comparison to the feats of Whitey Mack, but that was long enough to win him a reputation as one of the most daring commanders in the Soviet fleet. Yet through all this, he always remained superstitious and fearful of disaster. He once delayed deployment rather than leave without his crew's lucky mascot, Mashka, the rat. To buy time, he told an admiral that much of the meat in the ship's refrigerator was dated 1939. "Rat flight is a well-known sign," Bogdasarian says. "It was necessary to delay our departure." Black Lila, however, had no such good luck charm on that fateful day in 1970. Perhaps she should have. Bogdasarian says that he was moving Black Lila, formally identified as K-108, through a series of exercises, a set of planned revolutions through the water, similar to angles and dangles, much as Tautog's crew had guessed. By early in the morning of June 24th, his submarine was running circles at a depth of 40 meters and a constant speed of 5 knots. She came to periscope depth to scan for messages from shore. Then she went back to 40 meters and began to turn 90 degrees to her right. The idea was to practice checking for sounds in the area that had been shielded by the din of Black Lila's own propellers, just as the Americans had thought. As Bogdasarian tells it, his sonar men soon heard sounds that they identified not as an American submarine, but as a submarine imitator, an exercise device that looks like a torpedo and creates the same kinds of noises as a trailing submarine. 4 minutes later, they lost the contact. 2 minutes later, there was a crash. What happened next inside Black Lila was very much like what Tautog sailors say they heard, and very much like what they say they imagined. Black Lila's deck began to slant forward, first by 20 degrees, then by 30 degrees. The submarine was starting to slide out of control.
"We had 2,500 meters below us," Bogdasarian says. "I announced the emergency alarm, ordered to blow the main ballast bow part. No change. We started to blow the entire ballast. Useless again. The sub kept sinking. Gave an order, lock in compartments."
Silence in response. His crew was apparently in shock.
"Truth to tell, I began to doubt at that moment a possibility of successful surfacing,"
Bogdasarian says. He shouted at his stunned men. Finally, they began to report in.
"I hear air being slackened," sonar said.
By then the commander realized that they had collided with another submarine. The noise of slackened air could have meant that the other sub was sinking along with the Soviets, or it might have been surfacing. Bogdasarian's chief engineer, Volodya Dybsky, crawled into the control room, literally pulling himself by his arms. His legs were paralyzed with fear and shock. The engineer continued to give orders, lying down. Meanwhile, Black Lila continued to fall for what seemed like several minutes. Bogdasarian shouted what he thought would be his last order ever.
"Reverse!"
It was a desperation move. If his crew could reverse the engines, their sub just might drive herself to the surface. But descending this steeply, Bogdasarian knew the reverse clutch was likely to fail. Black Lila began to vibrate. Inside the sub,
"The depthometer's hand shook, then stopped near 70 meters. Then it moved back to 50 meters, to 25 meters. From the depth of about 25 meters, we went like a shot from the gun to the surface," he said. "Suddenly we appeared on the surface, like a cork from the champagne bottle."
After that dive, he added, referring to his men,
"They have a toast to the engines."
As soon as Black Lila hit the surface, her men opened a hatch. The sun was shining. They could see no other boat for miles around, and they feared the worst for the American sub.
"I thought for a second, I have sunk a brother submariner," Bogdasarian says. "It was hard to have realized it."
The Soviets were reporting the incident to their shore commanders when they caught the sound of what Bogdasarian now believes was Tautog moving away from the scene of the accident at 15 knots. Bogdasarian says his submarine limped back to port with only one propeller still working. Her right propeller shaft was hopelessly bent, and there was a large hole in her outer hull. The sounds of that outer hull cracking up could have created the popcorn effect recorded in Tautog's sonar room. But the echo had a second, reinforced inner hull. American submariners used to joke that the Soviets used a two-hull design because their metallurgy was, well, Soviet metallurgy. But it was very likely that the second layer of steel held back the crushing ocean and kept Black Lila's men alive. The hole in the outer hull
was so big that a trolley bus with antennas up could drive into it,
Bogdasarian recalls.
Truth to tell, if the Tautog had run into our sub a few meters closer to the center, we would have been very unlucky. The American submarine's speed was fairly high, and she would undoubtedly thrash both the light hull and the pressure hull of our sub.
Crammed into the hole between the inner and outer hulls, Bogdasarian believes, were pieces of Tautog. He says he was certain that the crash had completely sheared off Tautog's sail. Like the men on Tautog who had tried to hold onto pieces of the Echo, Black Lila crew members tried to keep pieces of the American sub for themselves, but the chunks of HY-80 were confiscated by the KGB. Only Bugdasarian, who refused to give his up, still has a souvenir. After that, Bugdasarian's story departs from the tale told by Tautog's crew. He insists that it was Tautog that rammed Black Lila, not the other way around. And he says that the Soviets tracked Tautog heading back to Japan. He also says Soviet intelligence sources reported that once there, Tautog remained to undergo a long overhaul. But Tautog never went to Japan. She returned directly to Pearl Harbor. When Bugdasarian returned to the Soviet Union, he faced a torturous hearing before a Communist Party commission. He says his squadron commander gave him advice.
Don't fly into a rage. Drop some tears on dusty boots.
A severe reprimand was registered on his service card. The transgression meant that he would no longer be allowed to teach at the Naval Academy. Instead, his boat was overhauled, then sent to spend 2.5 months hiding outside of San Francisco. This combat service, Bugdasarian says, was meant to make amends for his failure to wash out the fault with blood. After the crash, a new joke began to make the rounds among Soviet submariners, although the facts it was based on were altered somewhat, as no one wanted to be caught referring directly to a classified incident. With such constraints, it's little wonder that the humor is somewhat strained. The joke went like this. An American nuclear sub collided with an iceberg in the ocean. The iceberg's crew had no casualties. After about 6 months, Bugdasarian's superiors decided to rescind the reprimand. Somehow, it wasn't erased from party documents until many years later, and by then Bugdasarian wanted to hold on to his unique blemish. His reason? It would be hard to find a communist whose service card would say, severely reprimanded by the party for the collision with an American nuclear-powered submarine in underwater position. As Bugdasarian spoke, he paused and wondered aloud whether he might meet Commander Balderston, perhaps to have a drink and think together how to avoid similar collisions in the future. Told that Balderston had died, the former Soviet commander seemed crestfallen.
It's too bad about the commander, he said. I guess this incident did not pass easily for him.
Chapter 8 Oshkosh Bagosh. It was after 3 a.m., and even the Pentagon seemed almost still. Official Washington wouldn't start to churn for hours, not until the sun began baking the asphalt and concrete moat that surrounded the 34 acres taken up by the building. James Bradley sat beyond that moat, deep within the long cream-colored corridors, still on the fifth floor of the Pentagon's E-ring, behind three sets of locked doors, his suite of offices empty but for him. It was late 1970, Bradley's fourth year as the Director of Undersea Warfare at the Office of Naval Intelligence, and it was in these early morning hours that he could dream best, immersed in the quiet of his office and in the deep oceans beyond. He was preoccupied with notions bordering on the fantastic, plans for a new mission for Halibut, one that would shake the intelligence community even more than the photographs of the Soviet Gulf submarine that had so caught the imagination of President Nixon and, unfortunately for the Navy, the CIA. Bradley wanted to send Halibut into the heart of a Soviet-claimed sea after a quarry that was living, practically breathing, and beyond almost anything U.S. intelligence had attempted to grab before. Closing his eyes for a moment, he could almost see his target. It was a telephone cable, a bundle of wires no wider than 5 inches. But what a bundle of wires! Bradley imagined the cable as it ran from the Soviet Union's missile submarine base at Petropavlovsk, under the Sea of Okhotsk, and then on to join land cables going to Pacific Fleet headquarters near Vladivostok, and then to Moscow. If Halibut's camera-toting fish could find that cable, if her crew could tap it, then the United States would violate the very soul of Soviet secrecy. Here could be an open ear to the plans and frustrations of Soviet leaders, intelligence unmatched by any human spy or even the newest surveillance satellites floating high over the Kremlin. Bradley could almost hear the words flowing through the line. Technical analysis clear of propaganda, measures of the abilities and problems of Soviet submarines, information that might make them easier to trail, tactical plans for patrols that would take those submarines and their missiles near U.S. shores. If he was right, maybe the Americans could even grab the Soviets' own assessments of the test flights of ICBMs and sea-based missiles that smacked down on the Kamchatka Peninsula in the northern Pacific. That cable might provide entry inside the minds of Soviet commanders themselves. Of course, the Soviets would probably see Halibut's intrusion into Okhotsk as an act of piracy. If she were detected, they might try to board or destroy her, forcing an international incident that might end the delicate dance toward détente. And there was another hitch, a big one. Bradley had no proof that this cable existed at all. Even if it did, there was no way to tell where it lay beneath the 611,000 square mile expanse of Okhotsk. Even Bradley could see the humor in his predicament. How could he present this idea to the cadre of White House military, intelligence, and State Department officials who were supposed to have final say over an operation as dangerous as this one? How could he say that he wanted to send Halibut out on a hunch in search of an ethereal strand? Still, as far as Bradley was concerned, it was a pretty good hunch. After all these years of watching the Soviets, American intelligence knew that Soviet defense officials insisted on constant reports from the men in the field, and that the Soviets painstakingly coded most communications sent through the air to thwart interception. If Bradley's intuition was right, Soviet admirals and generals would be far too imperious and impatient to suffer an ocean of cryptographers already overwhelmed by the sheer bulk of their work. Top Soviet officers would want, would insist upon, an immediate and simple communications method. And the only simple and secure way to talk was through a hard-wired telephone system. Any telephone line the Soviets set up between the mainland and the submarine base at Petropavlovsk would have to run beneath the Sea of Okhotsk. Petropavlovsk was, after all, a tiny, desolate port across that sea, isolated on the Kamchatka Peninsula, and nearly hidden among ancient volcanoes and primeval birch forests. Okhotsk itself was almost empty, save for a few fishing trawlers and occasional submarines engaged in missile tests. The Soviets had to consider the sea secure, given that it was nestled into the crook of Kamchatka and the east coast of the Soviet Union as neatly as the Chesapeake Bay fits into the U.S. eastern seaboard. The way in for an enemy submarine or ship was through narrow, shallow channels that sliced through the Soviet-controlled Kuril Islands. Those channels could be easily blocked in an alert. But even if the cable was out there, where was it? Where, in all those miles and miles of water, lay a strand that couldn't be more than 5 inches wide? Bradley cleared his mind of charts and maps, freed himself from official assessments, from the meetings, memos, and briefings that swamped the business of intelligence in Washington. He let his eyes close, and his thoughts wandered to simpler journeys, taken in simpler times, before the Cold War, before World War II, back to the waters of his childhood. There he found an answer that was beguilingly simple, and just strange enough to be true. It was buried in his memories of St. Louis in the 1930s, when he was a boy and his mother packed him up to escape the summer's heat, on riverboat rides along the Mississippi River. From the point where the Mississippi meets the Missouri River, through Alton, Illinois, the boat steamed through water dyed with brown silt and banked by miles of floodplains painted with wild upward strokes of grasses until the green gave itself up abruptly to towering gray barrier bluffs. Eagles traced circles above, while sand cranes left leggy tracks along the shore. It was this scenery that captured most people riding the river, that and the riverboat orchestra and social scene on board. But for a boy, there were other sights that marked the trip. The young Bradley had taken to passing time with the steamer captains in the pilot house, and from there he could see a series of black and white signs placed discreetly along the shore. Most of the signs marked mileage and location, but there were a few, he remembered now, that declared, "Cable crossing, do not anchor." These signs were there to keep some idiot in a boat from snaring and snapping a phone or utility cable in the shallows. Bradley's eyes snapped open as he realized that what was true of the Mississippi just might be true of Okhotsk. That's how they would find the cable, he thought. That's how they would engineer one of the most daring acts of telepiracy of the Cold War. Halibut would be led directly to her quarry by signs placed somewhere on a lonesome beach in the Soviet Union, declaring, "Watch out, cable here." This wasn't the way intelligence operations were normally crafted in Washington, but Bradley's imagination had always been vast, sometimes too vast for the rigidity that often ruled much of the military crowd. He had been dreaming about a possible cable tap almost from the moment he had gotten the job and control of Halibut. He and his staff had spent hours talking about the possibilities for Halibut and that mythical communications cable. They scanned maps and pored over charts of Soviet seas and bases, and they soon came to realize that there were three spots that held special promise. Three places on the maps where Soviet naval bases were separated from Moscow by miles of water. The Baltic Sea, the Barents Sea, and the Sea of Okhotsk. Of these, only Okhotsk was truly desolate. Covered with a layer of ice 9 months of the year, the sea was as dreary and cold as Petropavlovsk, where nuclear submarines and missile arsenals were secreted among buildings that had been decaying for a century or more. Soviet naval officers made dingy homes in these cheap squares of concrete built among civil defense shelters and radar receivers. The more Bradley thought about Okhotsk and the sub-base on Kamchatka, the more he knew that Halibut was destined to go there. But throughout his first 3, even 4 years of directing her missions, there had been no safe way to allow men to leave a submarine, walk the sand 300 to 400 feet under the sea, and reach out and tap a cable. Bradley had to wait for the technology to catch up with his vision. And that had finally happened. The same post-Thresher panic that had prompted the Navy to put money into underwater research, the same push that had given birth to a redesigned Halibut, had also paid for a program to create new ways for divers to survive in the deep. Bradley's old friend John Craven had overseen much of this work until he retired from the Navy. Under Craven's direction, the ability of divers to work in the depths had progressed at an incredible pace. The problem had been daunting. What is life-giving air on the surface can kill divers down deep. By 300 feet down, air compresses so much that a single lungful contains about 10 times the surface amounts of oxygen and nitrogen. At these concentrations, oxygen becomes poisonous, and nitrogen has a drug-like effect, nitrogen narcosis, that makes divers go squirrely. Specially trained Navy divers and scientists had been experimenting with recipes for a new underwater atmosphere that replaced much of the oxygen and all of the nitrogen with helium, which is non-toxic. On ascent, those gases could be remixed to fulfill the diver's increasing need for oxygen in shallower waters. Animal experiments had given way to human underwater habitats called sea labs. Placed 200 feet down off La Jolla, California, the living was dangerous and uncomfortable. At one point, the plumbing failed on one, and the habitat tilted, but 4 divers inside survived on the new gas mixtures. Everything was progressing well until one of the sea labs developed leaks in 1969. A diver was killed while trying to make repairs. Not at all the kind of publicity the Navy was looking for just a year after a Scorpion had been lost. The Sea Lab program was unceremoniously canceled, and to outsiders it seemed as though the Navy had abandoned the effort altogether. But development quietly continued, and Bradley and Craven prepared to put the new gas mixture and the new saturation diving techniques to use for divers on halibut. The sub was now at the Mare Island Naval Shipyard outside San Francisco, being fitted with a portable version of Sea Lab, a pressurized chamber to support the divers as they acclimated to the water pressure they would find if they walked the seafloor to tap the Soviet cable. But before halibut could navigate the bottom of Okhotsk, Bradley had to win the funding and political support that the mission would require. Bradley's office was still the clearinghouse for all submarine spy missions. He and his staff collected wish lists from top policymakers within the National Security Agency, the Pentagon, and the White House. It was up to Bradley to come up with the operations that could fulfill those requests. The submarine trailings, the observations of missile tests, the gathering of electronic signals. Some of those missions were almost as far off the usual track as Bradley's imagined underwater cable, and not all of them were successful. In the early 1970s, a series of subs were sent to the Strait of Sicily to investigate what U.S. intelligence believed was a Soviet effort to plant an underwater system that would operate like SOSUS, one that seemed even more sophisticated than the sonobuoys that the British had destroyed a few years before. First, the USS Tullaby, SSN 597, was sent in and found a suspicious cable suspended high above the seabed. Then Lapon was sent in to try to snag the cable, but failed. After that, the USS Seahorse, SSN 669, and Rickover's NR-1 were sent in. Seahorse used her sonar to find the cable, then guided the small crew of NR-1 to the spot for what may well have been the first intelligence mission for the mini-sub. Finally, NR-1 got close enough to discover the Navy had been turning underwater backflips to check out a sunken Italian telephone cable left over from World War II. After that, Bradley had to sell those missions to the fleet commanders, who still had the final word on whether any of their submarines went out and where. Bradley had already made dozens of trips to Pearl Harbor, Norfolk, and Yokosuka, Japan, to brief and debrief submarine captains, and he had earned their respect and trust. Besides, the daring of the cable tap mission would make it an easy sell to these men. navigating through Washington required more of finesse. Still, Bradley knew how to court the crowd in this town, where information was currency, and was jealously distributed under the amorphous guideline of need to know. This was a place where power was measured by access, and Bradley traded access for approvals, packaging facts with a romantic haze of deep ocean wonders. His briefings drew on the storyteller's art that he had picked up decades earlier listening to his father weave wondrous yarns of wine, women, and sea. In fact, Bradley's idea to search for a Soviet cable was inspired almost as much by its dramatic impact as it was by its potential intelligence value. If that cable did exist, finding it and tapping it would do more to bring his office high-level exposure and funding than just about any mission he could think of. Bradley was already counting his successes in dollars and in enemies. His bounty usually came straight from the zipped pockets of other Navy departments. After he nearly decimated one project headed by a naval aviator, the man was ready to punch Bradley in the nose, right there in the Pentagon.
"You son of a bitch!"
swore the burly aviator, pouncing on the captain in the corridor. Bradley didn't blame him a bit. But Bradley was also unapologetic. He felt completely sincere in believing that his group was doing better work than anyone else. As long as his program had money, Bradley had power, and more of it than any four-striped Navy captain had a right to expect. He still reported to Rear Admiral Fritz Harlfinger, the Director of Naval Intelligence, and through him to Admiral Elmo R. Zumwalt, Jr., who was now the Chief of Naval Operations. But power or not, Bradley was still a captain in a town full of admirals, and a mere naval intelligence officer in a town where the top spooks reported to the president. There also were more than a few admirals who resented his refusal to take them into his confidence. One man, especially powerful within the Pentagon, insisted that he had to approve every operation before Bradley could send a spy submarine out. It was a directive Bradley found impossible to comply with.
"You gave me an order that was not legal,"
Bradley answered when the irate admiral confronted him. Then he added,
"By the way, I don't work for you."
The admiral stared Bradley down for what seemed like a long time. Finally he intoned,
"All right, you can get away with this time. But I'll tell you one thing, Bradley. You're never going to make admiral."
"So be it." Bradley stood his ground.
"So be it."
Then, with a soldier's flourish, he did an about-face and walked away, the drama of his departure filling him with satisfaction. There would be time enough later to realize that the admiral might just make good on his threat. At the moment, Bradley was more concerned with his battle with the CIA over control of Halibut. The agency had already snatched command of all salvage operations surrounding the sunken Gulf and was still waiting for Howard Hughes to finish building the monolithic salvage craft that would attempt to tear the entire sub from its ocean grave. Most of that was being engineered through the National Underwater Reconnaissance Office, the top-secret Navy CIA office that was still being run mainly by the CIA. Worse, the CIA seemed hell-bent on broadcasting news of all the Navy's best submarine missions and taking credit for them. When those missions were still entirely under Bradley's watch, fewer than a dozen top officials in Washington knew of the Soviets' lost submarine and Halibut's find. Now Bradley saw CIA officers assigned to Nuro handing out clearances like candy corn on Halloween. The Velvet Fist photographs, Halibut's abilities, and even other submarine spying missions were fast becoming the main attraction in a circus where having a ticket to the show was more important than the performance, where the labels Top Secret and need to know made the spectacle irresistible. Bradley saw every briefing as a potential leak. He wanted to be the one to go to Kissinger or his top deputy, General Alexander Haig, Kissinger's chief liaison to the military, and then only when the time was right. Bradley had worked hard to earn his access to the two powerful men. The captain played on his realization that Kissinger was the ultimate bureaucratic infighter, someone who wanted to control everything about foreign policy and covert actions affecting foreign policy. Bradley knew that more than anything else, Kissinger wanted to choose what would be presented to Nixon and wanted to make those presentations personally. As long as Bradley's missions reaped key intelligence, he knew the door would be open to Kissinger and to Haig. That had been clear the last time Bradley went to see Kissinger about Halibut's exploits. Kissinger was half an hour late. He walked in, leaned back in a chair, put one foot on a table in front of him, and pointed the other foot at Bradley. "Well," he began, his trademark German accent evident in every word. "You have got 10 minutes. Go ahead and start." Bradley knew better than to cower. "Dr. Kissinger, I can't do this in 10 minutes. If 10 minutes is all you've got, we ought to go away and come back and do this another time. Because with 10 minutes, we're just going to waste your time and mine."
"Well, well, you start, and I'll tell you when to stop."
More than 45 minutes later, they were still talking. It seemed a crucial victory to Bradley. Now the captain knew that news of the hunt for a sunken Soviet communications cable would be just the sort of exclusive that Haig would want to bring to Kissinger, and that the National Security Advisor would relish bringing to Nixon. Bradley had no intention of being scooped before he was ready to present his plan, so he told only the people who absolutely had to know, the Pacific Submarine Fleet Commander and Harlfinger. Normally, Bradley also would have marched his plan before a national oversight group known as the 40 Committee. Chaired by Kissinger, its ranks were filled with the country's highest national security officials, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the director of the CIA. It was the committee's job to evaluate all international covert operations, everything from CIA interventions in third world countries to eavesdropping operations aimed at the Kremlin. Other presidents had had similar oversight committees, and since the Pueblo incident, routine missions such as the usual submarine forays into Soviet coastal waters, or sorties flown by spy planes, were included in a monthly list for review. Committee members usually just provided a final glance before checking off boxes marked approved. But more dangerous operations, presumably any effort that carried as much risk as a plan to tap into a crucial Soviet communications line, were, in theory, subject to far more detailed hearings, where the operations were supposed to pass the most basic of all tests. Are the potential payoffs worth the risk? The riskiest missions were then supposed to be presented to the president for final approval. That was the primary job of the 40 Committee, to provide a test of common sense, a dispassionate analysis of what otherwise might be a no-holds-barred quest to gather intelligence. The committee was, in short, a layer of oversight designed to rise above parochial concerns, interagency rivalries, machismo, and the ever-present temptation to venture from the daring into the stupid. But that ideal was often little more than fantasy. The committee almost never marked any mission disapproved, and members of the intelligence agencies and the armed forces knew they could bypass the rest of the group as long as they didn't bypass Kissinger, who treated the committee as something to be utilized or ignored as he saw fit. Sometimes, after he okayed missions on his own authority, he He would poll the committee by telephone, seeking backdoor approvals. Sometimes he didn't even bother to do that. The message Kissinger sent was clear. The only oversight that mattered was his. That suited Bradley and Harlfinger, who in the spring of 1971 were happy to avoid a formal committee hearing. It wasn't hard for them to imagine what such a hearing would be like. Where were those signs? Along the Mississippi, you say? So, Captain Bradley, you say you came up with this sitting alone in your office at 3 a.m.? No. It would make so much more sense, Bradley reasoned, to try to get quiet approvals from the top, and to wait to tell the full committee about the plan once he knew for sure that the cable was there, to come in saying, "Look what we've done." Any step into Okhotsk, from the Soviets' point of view, was blatantly illegal, although the United States considered most of that sea to be open to international traffic, and a search for signs on a Soviet beach would have to take place at least partly inside the Soviets' 3-mile coastal limit, recognized internationally as sovereign territory. No one would see Halibut's jaunt inside as anything less than trespassing. Bradley hoped Kissinger would look past that, as much as he hoped Kissinger would ignore the fact that the timing for this kind of risk was just awful. Halibut would be trespassing when Nixon was publicly painting himself as a peacemaker and a statesman. The president had just gone on national television to declare that he personally had rescued flagging arms control talks in secret communications with Soviet General Secretary Leonid Brezhnev. All this left the captain apprehensive when he went to see Haig. With as few details as he could manage, Bradley outlined his plan to search out the cable. "If we can find it, we think we've worked out a way to tap it," he told Haig. There was also, Bradley said, a secondary mission, an underwater search for parts of a new kind of cruise missile being supplied to Soviet subs that stalked U.S. aircraft carriers. Haig asked no questions, offered no words of caution. He didn't even bother to bring Bradley before Kissinger. Instead, he said, "Keep us informed." Bradley realized he had just gotten all the official approval he would need. Haig would surely let Kissinger know, but the Navy's diciest plan had passed with the simplest approval process possible. Halibut was going to Okhotsk. By the summer of 1971, Halibut's refit was almost complete. In addition to the huge hump, the Bat Cave, that had inspired her conversion to a so-called special projects boat, she also sported an extra lump, a secret and crucial piece of equipment that was so ingeniously hidden atop her deck that the Navy proudly advertised its presence with no fear of a security breach. Local newspaper headlines heralded the accomplishment of this new addition, while intoning that the Navy had relaxed its secrecy surrounding Halibut. Halibut, the papers declared, was to be the mother ship for the Navy's first post-thresher deep submergence rescue vehicle. In fact, the lump wasn't a DSRV at all, but a diver's decompression and lockout chamber. Welded in place, it was where they would begin breathing the mixed gases developed at Sea Lab, and it was where they would get ready to go out and work underwater. In these final weeks before Halibut was to leave, Bradley's team began making frequent anonymous visits to Mare Island. Most of the sub's officers and crew knew them only as the men from Washington. Halibut's captain, Commander John E. McNish, wasn't revealing much more. Even in the final days before their October departure for Okhotsk, the crew still didn't know their destination. They knew only that they were leaving home for 3 months. That in itself was inspiration enough for the enlisted men to fill the submarine bars around San Francisco.
Some of these boys were only months past their high school proms. Others were salted chiefs, veterans of smelly diesel boats or the first nuclear submarines. Together they spent their final night on shore in an era when being a hard-drinking, chain-smoking man of the sea was not yet an anachronism. With their wives and girlfriends looking on, they drank themselves under the tables at Helen's. They drank until they danced buck naked on top of the tables at the Horse and Cow. This was their favorite place, the Whinny and Moo, to the initiated, with its darkened rooms, walls lined with photos of submarines, a klaxon cutting through the air to announce each new round, and stolen pieces of equipment crammed onto every free surface. Submarine commodes, plaques, dishes, ceremonial pennants, a torpedo casing, an anchor, enough contraband to drive naval investigators mad. Snorkel Patty was probably there. She almost always was at these last night events. For a decade, she had been mother, big sister, and lover to scores of submariners. She was the woman who knew what they would face on patrol without needing to be told, and she taught other young women braving the brash bar not to ask where or how or why. She was the woman who would make the men feel safe when they got home, a tender Mae West Mary Magdalene of the submarine set. In return, these men and boys gave her their hard-won silver dolphins, hundreds over the years. They gave her a volcano's worth of lighters decorated with their submarine insignias, and they gave her their undying adoration. The klaxon blew an air-driven howl, a wolf's song mated with the bray of a sick mule. The men drank some more and hooted, then hooted louder when some innocent knob walked into the place still wearing underwear. Just about everyone was checked, and anyone found wearing was unceremoniously stripped. Inspired, the veterans dropped their pants, stood on the bar, and turned around to show off the screws tattooed in twin sets, making sterns of their rears. Legend has it that those inked propellers would ensure a safe and speedy passage. The especially brash powered their screws with a long trail of paper from the head, planted in the only place possible on their naked bottoms. With the paper set afire, they raced smoky circles around the bar in what had become the ritual Dance of the Flaming Asshole. This was their celebration for finally getting out of the shipyard. This was a wake for their lost freedom. This was how the men of the Halibut launched one of the most critical submarine spy operations of the Cold War. The party wouldn't end until just a few hours before Smiling Jack McNish gave the final order to embark. Smiling Jack was the name the men had given their hulking commander, a testament to the tight grin that took the place of a growl or gritted teeth. It widened only with trouble. Few crew members remembered ever seeing the 38-year-old red-headed captain actually laugh. Not now, and not on Halibut 5 years or so earlier, when he had served as her executive officer. That grin would be there, unchanging, through most of the month Halibut spent transiting to Okhotsk. Any other attack submarine would have made the distance in less than 2 weeks, but Halibut's 1950s vintage reactor could not kick up past 13 knots, and she was further slowed by the drag of the fake DSRV on her back. Most of the trip progressed at an infuriating crawl of 10 knots as Halibut traveled a long arc, matching the curvature of the earth. Moving north to the Aleutian Islands, then down past the icy Bering Strait, past Soviet surface ships, she reached the Sea of Okhotsk. Getting inside the sea was tense business. The crew took several hours to maneuver through a shallow channel.
probably at the northernmost part of the Kuril Islands chain, just below the southern tip of Kamchatka. From here, the men had a periscope view of an active volcano, but they feared sunlight more. A single glint off the periscope, and any nearby submarine hunting plane or ship would find them. By now, they knew where they were. McNish had told them that much, and he told them the divers were going out on this mission. But he omitted any talk about Soviet cables. The commander instead declared that Halibut was there to find pieces of the new and deadly Soviet ship-to-ship missile. Only McNish, his officers, the divers, and a few men among those knighted as the Special Projects Team knew what they were really up to, as he ordered Halibut to move slowly up along the Soviet coastline, periscope up. Every 3 hours, Halibut moved along an S path, or cut a figure eight, or shifted from one side or the other, or circled around. Anything to give a peek into that blind spot in her baffles, to make sure no other sub followed from behind. The search continued for longer than a week. The men found nothing, but continued to look, to hope. Then they saw it, sitting along the beach, far up on the northernmost half of the Sea of Okhotsk, one of Bradley's signs proclaiming a warning to the careless, "Do not anchor, cable here," or something to that effect in Russian. At McNish's order, a fish was sent swimming out of the Batcave. By now, the problems with the video feed had been fixed. The pictures that came flying up into the submarine's monitors were still grainy and tinged with gray, but they were far clearer than the sonar images the men had to rely on while searching for the Gulf. Now the men staring at the monitors could even see vague shapes of Okhotsk's giant crabs, though only photographs would show the smaller fish, the clouds of luminescent plankton, the teeny jellyfish dancing diamonds as they were lit up by the mechanical fish's incandescent mechanical lights. Anything, no matter how large, that was more than a few feet from the cameras and lights, was lost in the murky water. Dark greenish-brown from silt runoffs. It showed up dark gray on the video monitors. Only a few men were cleared to look at any of this, but the novelty wore off quickly, and their shifts seemed to take forever as they stared at the screens for hours at a time. Then the sand seemed to rise slightly, a bump on the bottom, a foot or two long. The bump disappeared, then returned, a dash in the sand, followed by other dashes in the sand. At first the men wondered whether they were imagining a broken line within the gray. But there it was, again and again, periodic gray rises and more occasional glimpses of black. There was something there, something almost entirely buried in the sandy silt. Halibut began to follow the line. As the video images flickered on Halibut's monitor, the fish snapped 24 photographs a second. Later, the fish would be hauled up and gutted, refilled, and sent out again. The film promised images much clearer than this grainy video, but the ship's photographer wouldn't be able to develop any of the rolls until later, when Halibut could move high enough to the surface to snorkel and vent the toxic darkroom fumes. Finally, McNish gave the order, and Halibut came up in the privacy of a black night. The photographer began unraveling the rolls of film taken from the fish, working with the officer in charge of special projects. In the cramped darkroom, the two men watched the images emerge. There, in the color photographs, lay the Soviet cable. Now Halibut's crew had to find a flat strip on the sea bottom, a place to lower the two huge mushroom-shaped anchors at her bow and stern. McNish was looking for a spot well outside the 3 mile limit. There was nothing to be gained by tempting fate now. Ultimately, he settled on a place in the northern part of Okhotsk, about 40 miles off the western face of Kamchatka.
His men maneuvered the boat gently down to a place just above the cable. It took almost a day to move into position and anchor. The divers had been waiting in the fake DSRV, breathing the helium and oxygen mixture, for some time, and their bodies were acclimated to the increased pressure. Now they climbed into rubber wetsuits that fit loosely, leaving enough room for tubes that ran down their legs, their arms, into their hands, and around their bodies. A pump in the submarine would push hot water through the tubes as soon as they left the chamber, transforming the suits into something like rubbery wet electric blankets. The water would come through tiny holes in the tubing, seeping warmth against the chill of Okhotsk. It was November, and the water was at near freezing temperatures. The divers also wrapped insulation against their gas jets. There was no point in warming their bodies if they were going to breathe cold gas. Several times they checked their umbilical cords, the 2-inch-thick bundle of tubes and wires that provided the mixed gases for breathing, the hot water sluices, and the links for communication, power, and lighting. Running through the cord was one strong wire that had nothing to do with breathing, talking, or seeing. This was the emergency line, which would be used to yank them back into halibut should something go wrong. Their only other margin for error was latched onto their belts. Small bottles containing 3 or 4 minutes of emergency air, their come-home bottles. Finally, the men were ready to crawl out the outer hatch. In the control room, McNish could see them walking what seemed a spacewalk. Only barely lit by their handheld lights, they cut a ghostly path through the murky water to the communications cable. Once there, they began using pneumatic air guns to blow debris and sand away from the wire. As soon as it was clear, the men started to attach the tap, a device about 3 feet long that held a recorder filled with big rolls of tape. Off the main box was a cylinder that contained a lithium-powered battery. A separate connector wrapped around the cable and would draw out the words and data that ran through. The tap worked through induction. There would be no cutting into the cable, no risking an electrical short from seeping seawater. Inside the boat, men monitored the water currents, taking readings every 15 minutes or so. Halibut swayed against her anchors, while plainsmen struggled to keep her level through the hours that the divers worked to attach the recording device to the cable. After that connection was made, the spooks collected what seemed like an adequate sample of the Soviet voice and data transmissions running through the cable. Nothing in Halibut's history suggested that this would ever be so easy. The cable had been found without a single snag in the line towing the fish. The mission had gone so smoothly that much of the crew would remain firmly convinced that their submarine had happened upon the cable by sheer accident. They had, after all, been told that the target on this trip to Okhotsk was pieces of Soviet missiles. Now, true to his word, McNish turned halibut and headed for a Soviet test range. The water there was somewhat deeper than the waters over the cable. Still, halibut's fish quickly found a spot where the whitish-gray grains carpeting the ocean bottom became speckled with the steel gray and black of electronics and small shards of casing. Halibut had found a place where Soviet missiles went to die. This mission also was important, for these new Soviet cruise missiles posed a terrible threat to U.S. aircraft carriers. The weapons had a new kind of infrared guidance system that the U.S. Navy had been unable to counter. Bradley had already sent 3 standard U.S. attack submarines to Okhotsk with orders to try to get close enough to missile tests to record the frequencies of the infrared devices, as well as the frequencies of the new kind of radar altimeters that let the missiles skim close to the water surface and out of range of conventional U.S. countermeasures. The idea had been for the standard attack subs to use bulky devices attached to their periscopes to squirt bits of heat at the missiles to see what frequencies reflected back. The task proved impossible. At this point, the Navy was so desperate to learn whatever it could about any kind of Soviet cruise missiles that it had sent Swordfish, with sonar developed for halibut, side-lit and mounted on her hull, out to scour seabeds in shallow waters. The sonar worked so well that Swordfish could skim the shallows not more than 25 feet off the bottom, practically at flank speed. Only halibut could actually send men out to retrieve anything, and now her divers were out again, this time to pick up piece after piece. The hope was to find one of the infrared devices, or one of the radar altimeters. The divers stowed the pieces in a huge gondola-like basket hooked to halibut's steel underbelly. When the gondola was filled with hundreds of missile bits, the divers climbed back into the fake DSRV to wait out the long decompression process. They were there much of the time it took halibut to travel back to Mare Island. She docked about a month after she left Okhotsk. Before the crew could disembark, tapes from the cable tap were on their way to the huge National Security Agency complex at Fort George G. Meade. That complex, located halfway between Washington and Baltimore, was where the Defense Department sent most of the electronics intelligence picked up by submarines and other spy vehicles to be decoded and analyzed. Protected by three layers of barbed wire and fences, one layer electrified, were 5.5 subterranean acres of computers. These were used by some of the nation's top mathematicians and scientists to break Soviet codes. There were also thousands of Russian linguists and analysts poring over decoded communications. The massive operations building was nicknamed the Anagram Inn, and it was behind its 70,000 square feet of permanently sealed windows that the halibut's tapes would be played, replayed, and judged for content. Meanwhile, the missile fragments were sent to a Department of Energy lab, secreted away in the Pacific Northwest, a so-called black installation, with no outward signs of the work that went on inside. There, in a large, empty room, sat the basketfuls of junked missile pieces. Bit by tiny bit, engineers sorted through the baskets, laying out pieces on a long board. They were at it for months, but finally they had a board